Hello, I'm Howard Husick, Vice President for Policy Research at the Manhattan Institute, in another in our series of podcasts with the authors of books which are finalists for the $50,000 2015 Hayek Prize, which recognizes works published within the past 2 years that best reflect Nobel laureate economist Friedrich Hayek's vision of economic and individual liberty. I'm joined by William Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and director of its Development Research Institute. He's the author of The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. Professor Easterly is a 2008 Hayek Prize winner for his previous book, The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. Thank you for joining me, Professor Easterly.
My pleasure.
Tyranny of Experts is your third book on what might be called the shortcomings of development economics, the effort to lift the living standards of the poor in what, I don't know if we're still allowed to call it the third world, are we?
It keeps changing what we're allowed to call it. Yeah, you can call it the third world if you want.
But people know what that means anyhow.
Yes.
Well, your focus is somewhat less on poorly conceived projects in this new book and more on what other people might call human rights, including that of property ownership. So I was wondering what led you to that focus this time around, and to what extent is it tied up in the ideas of Hayek?
Well, I thought it was really time to move beyond the debate on whether foreign aid works, because even the most optimistic people on foreign aid, even their view would give a role to foreign aid that is not, it's not big enough to make the big difference between poverty and prosperity. So I thought it was time to hunt for bigger game, for the big things that really do make the difference between poverty and prosperity. And also my intellectual journey really consisted of kind of an awakening to how much the rights of the poor are violated in the routine business of the development industry.
Let's get to that in a minute, but I want to focus for a minute what you said in passing, that foreign aid would, if we're still allowed to call it foreign aid for that matter,
development assistance
was never going to get us or get developing countries over the hump toward development. You know, there's still discussion about does the West give enough as a percentage of their economies? So all of that seems kind of beside the point to you.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think there was a time to have that debate, and I participated in that debate. I'm glad I did. But I think that debate is sometimes mistaken for the most important question. It really is not the most important question. The most serious question is the one that we talk about in this book, which is, you know, do the poor have the right to be free? Is the right to be free a key to their prosperity, as I think it is?
And so connect the dots. You know, Milton Friedman wrote about democracy and freedom. You're reinvigorating that nexus, if you will.
Yeah.
But connect those dots for us.
Yeah, I think there's a great tradition in economics of people have written about the link between economic freedom and political freedom, that it's really all one package, that the two go together empirically, that they almost always happen together, and that one without the other is really unsustainable, that you really need the whole package of political and economic freedom, which is what Friedman and Hayek both very strongly argued, to achieve both the moral good of freedom in and of itself, of course, which is the most important thing of all, and second of all, to sustain prosperity in any society.
And why do they go together? And maybe how do they go together? You talk in the book about landowners who find that their farms are burned capriciously. Obviously, if you lose your property to tyranny, you can't accrete property gains. But talk more about how political and economic freedom interrelate.
Yeah, let's use that example that you're referring to. So this were some farmers in a district of Uganda called Mubende that suddenly woke up one morning and found men with guns burning down their homes and crops and marching them off their own land at gunpoint. And it turned out this was a project financed by the World Bank with complete indifference to the human rights and political rights and economic rights of these poor people. This story appeared on the front page of the New York Times, but this the norm of freedom and rights is so weak in development that it really had no consequences for kind of shaming the World Bank into changing its actions or even apologizing or investigating what happened. It never has been held accountable for what happened in that one incident. And that's just reflective that even when you're on the front page of the New York Times, the World Bank and the development industry can sort of get away with impunity these rights violations. So let's think of these farmers whose rights are violated. So their political rights were violated. They had no ability to protest. Their economic rights were violated. Their property was taken away from them at gunpoint. And it obviously would not make a lot of sense to kind of slice and dice the rights of these farmers, to say, you know, well, we care only about the political rights, or we care only about the economic rights. To those farmers, it was all one big package, you know, that their rights were violated and they had no recourse of protest, no recourse of free speech, no recourse of voting to penalize everyone who was responsible for those rights violations.
And what's the temptation then for development entities like the World Bank to get drawn into projects like that, in which they have this sense that wiping the slate clean and starting afresh is going to lead to prosperity? You talk about the tyranny of experts. What tempts them to that tyranny?
Well, to be fair to them, it's really a sort of unintentional tragedy. They're very focused on the material poverty of the poor. They can think of a bunch of technical solutions to those problems of the poor, you know, like nutritional supplements or fertilizer for the farmers' crops that will make poor people's lives better off. And, you know, implicitly, they're sort of going to go along with the authoritarian status quo that's in place to implement those technical solutions. They're looking to an autocrat who they often sort of think of as a kind of a benevolent autocrat who will do their expert advice for all these technical solutions. So it's a package of ideas that is kind of understandable in the business that they are in, which is mainly, you know, technical solutions to material problems. This tragedy comes when they become sort of the spokesman for what causes development. And what causes development is not experts and autocrats. What causes development is the freedom and rights of poor people for themselves, which this Uganda story illustrates. Obviously, the fertilizer and the nutritional supplements are not going to do these farmers any good when their homes are being taken away at gunpoint, their crops are torched, their livestock are shot. These are the things that matter at the ground level for development.
But of course, there may be a longer time horizon to this more decentralized, Hayekian, if you will, approach to development based on the unplanned plans of so many dispersed people. And in a sense, you're saying, create a system of rights and trust it to bloom.
Right. That's why these ideas are not very popular in the development establishment. Hayek himself has a great quote to that effect, which I'll paraphrase, that he said, the economist is sort of the unpopular person who points out why all your technical shortcuts are not going to work as quickly or as nicely or as emphatically and in great magnitude as you want or expect. And, you know, I have an alternative solution, but sorry, it's going to take longer. It's more gradual. It depends on poor people themselves asserting their own rights. And that really leaves the development establishment frustrated, and they don't want to go there. But I'm sorry, that's where the road to prosperity and the road to freedom is a good thing in itself. That's where the road goes.
Right. And you can't cut a ribbon on that, can you? Exactly.
No. And, you know, I think the other thing is the sort of like that makes the development establishment resist freedom as kind of an answer in development is the sort of what can we do question, which we, the rich people in the West, so the well-meaning people, humanitarian people, that we want to be implicitly, we sort of are drawn to approaches where we're kind of the star of the show.
Yeah.
You know, that it's our technical solutions that make this great difference between poverty and prosperity. And, you know, the humility of the freedom approach is saying we are not the stars of the show. The experts don't know what to say to transform the lives of poor people. It's the poor people themselves who know the answer if they're allowed to be free.
I'm guessing that you would urge us to be more expansive about allowing the imports of goods that poor people produce abroad rather than exporting our own solutions to them.
Absolutely. I mean, there's lots that we can do to make prosperity possible by opening our markets and also opening our borders. I think migration is a complicated question, and there's no single one utopian answer to migration. But I think a much more generous and free attitude towards the movement of peoples is part of the solution to development also. And a much more generous attitude toward the movement of goods and allowing poor people to prosper by selling goods to us is part of the solution.
Yeah, it's incredible. Africans grow cotton, but we protect non-African cotton farmers in the United States.
Oh, yeah, there's lots of examples like that. And sugar is another one. There's lots of, like, Haiti is a good place to grow sugar. Many poor countries in the Caribbean are great places to grow sugar, but we penalize them by protecting our own pitifully small group of sugar growers who are very politically influential and have these huge barriers to sugar imports. So there are many examples like that.
Of things we can do.
Of things we can do. And actually the biggest thing of all that we can do is kind of fight for the ideas of freedom. I think we, this what can we do question sort of leaves out the whole question of intellectual and moral debate. And that's frankly what we don't have enough of in development. People kind of want to downplay that because we're so focused on these tangible kind of quick fix solutions. But intellectual and moral debate is a huge force for social change. You know, we have this big war of ideas in the world today between freedom and unfreedom, between democracy and autocracy, between economic and political freedom and oppression by governments and oppression by elites. And that's the battle of ideas that we need to have today, because people are choosing sides, are making decisions. You know, the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, announced that he was convinced that autocracy works better for development and started doing all sorts of repressive measures in Hungary under the belief that autocracy works better than freedom for development. So, you know, these ideas, they do have an impact on in very unpredictable but very powerful ways around the world. So it's very important that we win the battle of ideas for freedom as opposed to autocratic oppression.
Well, of course, that brings us to China. And if there's an autocratic example that even columnists for the New York Times are tempted to praise, it is China. And you could say China is influenced by the Singaporean model, right? Which is a limited dissent, a strong, benevolent dictatorship. Many schemes, as the British call them, for development. China is one of the great economic success stories of history so far. So yeah. What say you?
Yeah, I always, whenever I give a talk, I always write down after the talk a little prediction card that the first question of after the talk will be, what about China?
I waited.
And the prediction always comes true, almost always comes true. So two things about China, and for that matter about Singapore. One is, I think that we take an approach to evidence that this book calls the blank slate, that we sort of wipe the slate clean of all the history of freedom and prosperity and development. So we leave out the long-run historical success of almost all the countries that are now rich in the world today, in Western Europe and North America and Australia, New Zealand, Japan, which all have freedom at the heart of their story. So that's one way in which this focus on China is getting it wrong. The second way in which the focus on China is getting it wrong is the reason we're excited about China is because of its rapid economic growth rate. So the level of per capita income in China is still, you know, far below that of the U.S., 1/10, 1/6. We don't really know, depending on the very shaky numbers. And so, you know, it's not the levels that are getting us excited about China. It's the growth rate. Growth rate is a change. It's a percent change in how fast the level of development is rising. So we should look for a change explanation for a change story. China is a change story. What is the change explanation? Well, actually, the freedom story in China is terrible in levels, but it's positive in changes. There has been a positive change in freedom in China, certainly a huge change in economic freedom compared to the centrally planned totalitarian economy under Mao, and even a positive change in political freedoms and personal freedoms compared, again, to the totalitarian famine, you know, disasters under Mao. There's been a positive change. So the story actually fits China, that there's progressive liberalization of freedom in China, still a long way away from anything that approaches, you know, freedom in the level sense. And that process will have to continue if China is going to keep growing. And if it doesn't continue, then China will stop growing. And I think there could be signs of that already.
In other words, even absent even that modest liberalization, China would not have blossomed, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Finally, what countries inspire you? I think perhaps of India. Where do you look for, not confirmation of your ideas, but where do you look for the next beacon of Hayekian success, if you will?
Yeah, well, again, let's my insistence that we not have a blank slate. The first country that inspires me is my own country, the United States. We've had 250 years of economic growth responding to the idea that men are born free and equal back in 1776. And, you know, then more recent examples have seen the spread of political and economic freedom around the world and a great response in prosperity. Places like South Korea, Taiwan. Taiwan is the China example that we usually forget. Taiwan had first a big change in economic freedom and then had a movement to democracy, political freedom and now has the whole package. The same in South Korea. There was, and you know, those were not the way that they're usually portrayed, which I think is wrong, that these were sort of the benevolent actions of autocrats who decided on their own to give up some of their power and allow more freedom. There may be some of that there are autocrats that let that happen in Taiwan and South Korea. But I think it's also the resistance and protest movements in those countries that demanded first more economic freedom and then more political freedom and succeeded. And now Taiwan and South Korea are great success stories.
And India? I got to go back to that.
Yeah, India is sort of a strange in-between example. Remember, India's at independence had practically a centrally planned economy.
Right.
And it had majority voting, but democracy and political freedom are a lot more than majority voting. You know, India had the caste system in which there was oppression of lower caste by upper castes. They had a sort of majoritarian tyranny in which there was not enough protection of individual rights and religious minorities, which is still a big issue today in India. And so it's very important that we remember that democracy is not just majority voting. That's a very, very big misconception about the freedom debate. And so I think that's why India is not such a clear-cut case. It has majority voting, but it lacks a lot of the other characteristics of even political freedom. And then economic freedom has been a real struggle in India. I think some of the recent success in the past couple of decades in India have again resulted from positive changes in economic freedom, and that's let India grow a lot faster than it did before.
True story, and you're sticking to it.
I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Bill Easterly.
My pleasure.
He's a finalist. His book is a finalist in the 2015 Hayek Prize competition here at the Manhattan Institute. It's called The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. Once again, thank you, William Easterly.
My pleasure.